calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be in the planet. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live all across the United States on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio. Conservative David Eikenson will be here saying, read my lips, no new tariffs, in the next hour of our program. And in the third hour, Abigail Alien will be letting us know about the coral reef crisis and what it means for us. What do reefs have to do with us? We'll find out. Serious stuff. Serious stuff. First, we have, and by the way, a three-hour-long Berlusconi alert. Amazing things going on in Italy with the Italian elections. Silvio Berlusconi, of course, the small-time crook and businessman, and I call him a crook and businessman because most or many of his early business associates are now in prison. The Parliament of Italy had to pass a special law saying that the prosecutions of Silvio had to be postponed until he was no longer prime minister. One of the reasons why he might be hanging on to power. Well, first of all, yesterday the exit polls came out and they showed that Berlusconi was losing by 4, 5, 6, 7 points. This is really interesting. This is sort of the same way the rest of the world was watching the U.S. elections. You know, the exit polls came out and showed that Kerry was winning. And then the voting machine polls came out and showed that Bush was winning. Well, in Italy, turns out Accenture was brought in to manage the voting rolls. Yes, that company that helped Catherine Harris down in Florida. And I have several reports, and I'm looking for, I have actually one news report, but it's in Italian, suggesting that Berlusconi had actually brought voting machines into 26 sensitive districts. And all of a sudden, the polls now are showing that it's a dead heat. Well, actually, now it's showing Prado won. Berlusconi's opponent, out of 43 million votes that he won by some 25,000 votes. And so Berlusconi now wants a recount. A lot of people questioning, you know, was this election even rigged in the first place? But we'll get to more detail on that as we go through the program. Right now, Michael Putenat is with us, PUTEGNAT.com, his website, his last name as well. Michael, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Well, thank you, Tom. Glad to be with you.
You've written a book called Laguna. You're the president of MP Advertising, consulting firm that advises government agencies and businesses across the U.S. You're also fairly outspoken about immigration. And on your website, you have this immigration matrix, which seems to me to be a reasonable summary of some of the problems we're facing and some of the values that Americans hold. But the core take I have here is that you're an advocate of building a fence. Is that right? Or do I have something wrong?
You got that wrong. Well, let's put it this way. Here's some utility in a fence. When you think of the Great Wall of China, the Berlin Wall, the Maginot Line, the Siegfried Line, you got to admit they're great tourist attractions eventually.
Yeah, there you go. So,
But as a means to keep a good man from feeding his children, they're worthless.
Yeah, yeah. So what do you see as the solution to the immigration problem, Michael Putnam?
In a nutshell, Tom, we are confused by what we're hearing because this is really two distinct issues and not one issue. Everyone thinks it's illegal immigration, but it's not just illegal immigration. It's the issue of legal immigration as well. Because if it were just illegal immigration, and that would answer the complaint, it's against the law and it's a threat to our border security, the simple solution is to let people walk across the bridge, put their thumbprint down, take a picture, put down their $60, and have at it.
Well, as we did in the United States up until 1920.
Exactly. But when you offer that option to some folks, they go reeling crazy, because the real reason is all about immigration. The reason most people immigrate to the U.S. is to escape economic distress. In the U.S., an immigrant earns 15 to 20 times the income he'll get from Mexico. And the fact is this, we look at this and we know that the reason why we have such a visceral response from some people, a negative to this, is it's fear. I mean, the core of it is the Mexican and Hispanic population in general is growing almost three times faster in the U.S. than the U.S. overall. And by 2060, non-Hispanic whites, which is the folks who think of themselves as the status quo, will comprise less than half of the U.S. population. And by 2100, Hispanics will be the majority ethnic.
Right. This is the statistic that the racists among us are quite hysterical about.
Well, now think about this, though. if you have any confidence at all in the idea of America, which is freedom, self-determination, openness, what would make you think, is the question I put forward, that these folks would want to divide and reduce it, but in point of fact, come here to multiply it? And I'll give you this little...
Right, in other words, it doesn't matter what color your skin is, it doesn't matter what nation you originally came from, if the ideals of democracy have any validity, and people are coming here in part because they believe in those ideals, they'll simply adopt them.
Well, in fact, isn't that exactly what has happened? Now, think
sure.
about this. These folks are basically looking back at America, these folks that are, againers in this deal, and they're thinking about the traditions of America and the culture of America and worrying about losing it. But America's never been a place that focused on the past. That would be Great Britain. America's been focused on the future. And the fact is, the future is already present. I'm going to give you an insight here that if people would stop for a moment and think and drop the hysteria. I live in the border region of Texas. My family's been here for over 100 years, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So 100 years of living on the border where it's 95% Hispanic. And the fear that we are hearing about is the 100 years hence in 2100. So if you want to know what America might be like in terms of culture and patriotism and all the other values that you might want to pinpoint, you could look at South Texas right now. And the fact is this, look, we eat hamburgers and we eat tamales. I mean, we read Shakespeare, we read Cervantes. We like Springfield and Salina. I mean, in school, I studied right here, Jefferson, Paine, Franklin, Thoreau, Emerson. And you know what? I used to sit and listen when I was a little kid to all the veterans talking about World War II and the Korean War, and they're all Hispanic names.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is this, life here is pretty good. We're bouncing bronze babies maybe on white knees, but in fact, if this is the future that these folks are fearing, I can tell them to relax.
Well, I think the concern, yeah, I agree with you, Michael. I agree with you. And you know, this whole eugenics issue, which is really, I think, the province of the extreme right, you know, the Tim McVeighs of the world, frankly. I mean, you know, the white wasp Christian reconstructionist, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I think they represent a very small fringe, and you know, tragically, they get involved in these discussions. But there is a larger issue, and that is that countries have borders for the same reasons that cells have membranes. That you have to have an internal homeostasis of some sort. There has to be balance. You have to have, you know, within a cell, you have to have balance between particular elements or particular chemicals. You have to, you know, bring in nutrients and excrete waste. All those kinds of things. There's a reason for that membrane. There's a reason why nations have boundaries and borders. And one of those reasons has to do with people getting together. I mean, this is the instinct of family writ large, right? Writ national. People get together and say, this is the way that we want to live. These are the standards of life that we want to have, economic standards, political standards. And there is a realization, and this is why every country in the world controls immigration, there's a realization that uncontrolled immigration will threaten, at the very least, the economic standards of a nation. That is to say that, you know, in 1813, when David Ricardo wrote his treatise on the Iron Law of Wages, he made the observation that in an unlimited labor supply economy, the price of labor will drop to a subsistence level and remain there. And people in the United States have historically said, you know, we don't want labor to be at a subsistence level. We'd like labor to be a little more scarce so that the price of labor goes up.
I think for a fact, you are exactly right that there is a place we want to define ourselves and we need a boundary to do that. But as a practical fact, the approach we are taking is not one that's likely to succeed, and I only point to the last 20 years in the arrival of 11.
No, I'm agreeing with you that a wall is not going to do it.
Yeah.
You know,
let me give you some ideas that would do it.
Okay, we have 1 minute here, Michael.
All right, we have 50,000 Mexicans working in American factories in Matamoros across the border from me. They're not immigrating to the United States; they're staying there. By a Marshall Plan investment in Mexico, we could help people stay at home. Now, in the time I got left, I just want to say there's a lot more to this than is simply discussable in 10 minutes. I've got that information at my website. If people want to go look and read more about it, love to have them at pugnat.com
or PUTEGNAT.com. Yeah.
Right, or easier to remember is lagunabook.com.
Okay. Yeah, okay. All righty. Why have a Marshall Plan for Mexico, though? Why not simply say to Vicente Fox, hey, you know, your corrupt government has to reform itself?
Well, then we need to stop propping up the corrupt government in Mexico, which is what we do.
I agree with you. I agree with you. Michael Putinat, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you.
Bye-bye.
16 minutes past the hour. It's a Tom Hartman radio program where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
So that's how it is. That's what we got. And if the president wants to admit it or not, you can read it in the paper, read it on the wall, hear it on the wind if you're listening at all. Get out of that limo and look us in the eye. Call us on a cell phone, tell us all why. In Dayton, Ohio, or Portland, Maine, or a cotton gin out on the great high plains. It's done closed down along with the school and the hospital and the swimming pool. Dust devils dance in the noonday heat. There's rats in the alley and trash in the street. Gang graffiti on a boxcar door. We can't make it here anymore.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Our website, if you want to drop by, tomhartman.com. Click the live chat link and drop into our live chat room. There may be a day or so where the website is behaving kind of flaky, by the way, as we're making some changes in our servers. Just a heads up, not to worry. The whole right-wing response to the immigration, this is incredible, on Fox News. They hosted a panel discussion about this thing, and the slogan on the screen, with Your World with Neil Cavuto, I guess his name is, perfect chance to arrest illegal immigrants, asks the question, and then it shows a picture of hundreds of thousands of people at the rally. Yeah, right. I mean, it's just, how many people for how long are going to just completely demagogue this issue? I mean, it's amazing. And, for example, down on KFYI in Arizona, Brian James, right-wing talk show host.
What we'll do is randomly pick one night every week where we will kill whoever crosses the border. Step over there and you die. You get to decide whether it's your lucky night or not. I think that would be more fun.
Yeah, that would be great fun, wouldn't it? I mean, can you get how weird this is going? Now, at the same time, we have a president who is talking about leading us into a nuclear war in Iran and perhaps bringing about the battle on the plain of Armageddon in northern Israel, which I suspect he thinks would be a good idea because he's been reading Tim LaHaye's books or something like that. And then on top of that, now, as I mentioned, our latest Berlusconi alert for the day. Gianni Barbacetto and Mario Portanova, the authors of the report, consider the involvement of Telecom Italia EDS Accenture, which is organizing the electronic vote, the real danger for Italian democracy. Why? Because they're private agencies and because Accenture is the same agency which organized the vote in Florida. But there's more. These agencies have been chosen by a private contract. No public bidding, no public announcement. And why would that be? Well, could it be that Gianmario Pisanu, a partner of Accenture, of the Italian incarnation of Accenture, Accenture, by the way, I believe is what used to be Arthur Anderson, is the son of Italian minister Giuseppe Pisanu, friend of Silvio Berlusconi's? I mean, it's really pretty incredible when you consider it. Here's, first of all, the article in The Guardian. This was in yesterday's Guardian, the British newspaper. The projection, this is from the Italian election. Keep in mind, Silvio Berlusconi, for the last 5 years, he's been prime minister. He's the guy who owns all the radio stations, all the TV stations, all the radio networks, all the TV networks, and several of the newspapers in Italy. A billionaire and a media mogul. The guy, and then once he got control of the government, he put in charge of the state-run television, their equivalent of public broadcasting, one of his cronies, not unlike Bush has done. And so Silvio Berlusconi is running against Prodi, this fellow who center left, they described him as. We described his yesterday. I went through his Prodi's platform and all the things that he said he was going to do. And it seems, he's a fairly progressive guy, 66 years old. And the projections here from the article in the Guardian. The projections from actual vote returns were different from the results of exit polls. Say what? We've seen this movie before. This is what the world saw when they were looking at our elections in 2006. Back to the Guardian. Two Nexus exit polls. This is Nexus, right? This is serious, good, well-done exit polls. Two exit polls suggested within 45 minutes of the close of polls indicated that in voting Sunday and Monday, Prodi's coalition had garnered between 50 and 54% of the vote in both the upper and lower chambers of parliament, while Berlusconi's coalition had between 45 and 49%. Both exit polls gave Prodi's union coalition between 159 and 170 seats in the Senate, compared with 139 and 150 for Berlusconi. In other words, this guy was beating Berlusconi's pants off. He was trouncing him. And this morning in the Wall Street Journal, the election is in doubt. It looks like Berlusconi might have won. And then they finally get down to the very final count, and it looks like Berlusconi only lost by 25,000 votes. Oops, somebody goofed. And I've got this website in Italian. I know il brogli rientro nella provincia. In any case, the summary of this thing, in the bad Google translation of it, in four delicate regions, the electronic ballot is experienced. They brought in voting machines from the United States in areas where Berlusconi thought he was going to be lost. I'm reading from this article in the weekly magazine in diario.it. You can read it. It will be managed by Accenture. Amazing. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Shake it up. Shake it up.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour of Tom Hartman here with you. Of the 11.1 million illegal immigrants, USA Today has a pretty good summary here. This is from the Pew Hispanic Center, by the way. And in fact, I was on the website of the Pew Hispanic Center this morning, and it was fascinating to see their study of the opinion of Hispanic Americans about illegal immigrants. And 40% were in favor of some sort of path to, roughly 40%, some sort of path to citizenship. And a little over 50% were opposed and basically said they should go back to where they came from. 50.1%, something like that. I don't have it right here in front of me. But in any case, here, of the estimated 11.1 million illegal immigrants who came to the USA from 1980, from the day Ronald Reagan came into office until March of this year, 40% of them arrived just during the Bush presidency. Roughly 4.4 million people have come into this country illegally since George Bush became president. Whereas during the years 1995 to 1999, there were 2.9 million, estimated 1990 to 94, 2 million, and from 1980 to 89, that entire 10-year period, 1.8 million. So we went from 1.8 million during the first 10 years to 2 million the next 4 years. The 4 years following that, 2.9 million, and then the last 4 years, 4.5 million. 56% of them are from Mexico, 22% from the rest of Latin America, 13% from Asia, 6% from Europe and Canada, and 3% from African nations. The most concentrated industries, private households, 21%, food manufacturing, 14%, farming, 13%, furniture manufacturing, 13%, construction, 12%, textile manufacturing, 12%, food services, 12%, administrative and support services, 11%, hotels, 10%, other manufacturing industries, 6%. And this is interesting. Where they work, service industry, 31%, construction, 19%. Increasingly, it's becoming obvious to me that we have really, in terms of the problem that we have right now in the United States, only two solutions. One solution is to say the only way to become a citizen of the United States is through the normal path to citizenship. In other words, get in line and criminalize the hiring of illegal aliens. And at that point, you know, many people will leave the country. Others will stay, but it'll be an underground situation. But at that point, this whole building a fence thing, this is silly. But if there's no job for people, they're not going to come here. I mean, look at this. 4.5 million people just since George Bush became president. Why? Because, hey, you're welcome here where there's going to be no prosecution. You know, Walmart gets a slap on the wrist kind of thing. So number one, either say, you got to go home and start over. Or number two, fully legalize everyone who's here and say, okay, you're citizens now, period. And at the same time, criminalize the hiring of the illegals and say, this time we really mean it. Back in 86, when Reagan did this, gave an amnesty, we didn't mean it. In fact, that's really when it really started picking up steam, was in the late 80s. But now we really mean it. And actually start, and throw some employers in jail to prove that you mean it. The thing in between of, you work for 2 years or 4 years or 6 years and you can become a citizen and this and that and the other thing, it's just not going to work. It will work, but the tragedy of it is that it will be another 4, 5, 6 years of people basically being indentured servants. It's just extending the lifespan. It's reinventing the Bracero program. The Bracero program, it didn't work. It did bring a lot of people to this country. It did bring in a lot of cheap labor. It did work over the short term for the corporations who were the recipients and users of it, but it didn't work for Americans. And frankly, I don't think it worked for Mexicans as well, because Mexico is still a corrupt nation. And if the United States was not available as a valve, a release valve, then perhaps the Mexican government would have changed. And they may still. We'll see. 1-866-440-8466. Matt in Castleton, Vermont. Hey, Matt.
Good afternoon, Tom.
Hey.
I just wanted to comment on Brian James, radio host you mentioned, who said it would be more enjoyable, I guess, to kill illegals coming across the border.
Yeah.
I was reading on some blogs last night, and I guess the radio station's response to this was basically, he's a fill-in host, it's not our problem. They just said that they don't condone what he said. If you called the radio station and said to them, how would you feel if we threatened to shoot one of your hosts because we didn't like their rhetoric, they would call the police on you.
Sure.
It's absurd. You'd probably have the police knocking down your door, but that's the equivalent of what he's doing.
Yeah.
The whole thing is just absurd.
I know. And it demonstrates the level of irrationality that the conservatives are bringing to this thing. Tragically, the racist element of the conservatives. Although he went on in his rant to say, I'm not a racist. If a white guy was illegally coming into this country, I'd shoot him too.
Oh, well, that
now we're all reassured.
That solves the problem.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Well, the beautiful thing that keeps me going every day is you can feel the pendulum swinging the other way, and I hope it continues to swing and sticks for a long time.
Yeah, I agree with you. Thanks a lot, Matt.
Thank you.
Great to hear from you. And my only concern is that we may end up with a situation similar to the Berlusconi situation. Berlusconi is now asking for a recount, and he may well get it. After all, he owns the country for all practical purposes. And if he can get rid of those 25,000 votes, he becomes prime minister. And if you look at the exit polls, it shouldn't have been a 25,000 vote margin. He lost by millions and millions of votes. But he brought in Accenture, and he brought in electronic voting machines at the last minute in these sensitive areas. And if these news reports are right, if what I'm looking at here is correct, and I'm trying to find more solid sources on this. Edie in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Edie, what's up?
Well, I wanted to say something about Vicente Fox.
Yes.
And until he has some motivation or some reason to help us with our border problem, it just won't happen. And
well, he's going the other way. He's published a brochure for people on how to get across the border safely.
I assume so, because he gets rid of some of his poorest of the poor people, so he doesn't have to take care of them. And it takes, and it, from what I've heard, it's the second biggest industry in Mexico.
It's
billions of dollars that they keep sending back to the poorest of the poor families, so he doesn't have to take care of their family so much.
That's right. $17 billion a year goes into Mexico from the United
States.
It's the second largest source of revenue for that country behind their oil industry.
Well, that's what I heard, and so there's no reason for Mr. Fox to do anything to help us.
Yeah, no.
Well, then, Mr. Bush is just making noises when he talks to him.
Yeah, well said, Edie. Thank you very much. I agree with you, and Fox is a disaster. In fact, actually, he may not. We'll see how the election comes out. I think it's in May or June, in the Mexican elections. Amy in San Diego, California. Hey, Amy.
Hey, Tom. I know that you're... one of your ideas are, and I totally believe it, you know, that they say that they're only doing jobs Americans won't do. And it just dawned on me.
That's such nonsense.
It is completely nonsense, because there are Americans here right now doing those jobs. I work at a large university in California, and we have groundskeepers who are American citizens, and they are paid a living wage. They get between $12 and $15 an hour, and they get benefits. And they are doing groundskeeper's work right now. So that's just true baloney, and there's proof that they're doing it right now.
Yeah, whenever you hear one of these conservatives, and I've including Democratic Party conservatives, say on TV, oh, there's just some jobs Americans won't do,
right.
I just want to puke. I mean, I remember, I forgive the phraseology, but I remember as a kid watching the old Jackie Gleason show. Jackie Gleason played Ralph Crampton, who was a bus driver, and his best friend was Ed Norton, who played by Art Carney, who worked in the sewers of New York. And he would come home with his waders on, and everybody would go, whoo, you know, go take a shower, Ralph.
Yeah.
And they lived in a walk-up apartment in Manhattan, you know, a cold water walk-up. And I mean, that was the American middle class at that point in time in the early 1950s.
Right.
And it's, well,
so we can just remind people,
here,
yeah, Americans are doing them right now if they get paid the right amount.
Yeah. Well,
thanks,
so
Tom.
Good. Thanks, Amy. Great to hear from you. Brett in Spartanburg, North Carolina. Hey, Brett.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm great. What's up?
I got a solution, maybe, perhaps. If we required all the companies that took our jobs overseas to pay their workers over there a living wage, then they would become consumers where they are.
And that is happening in China right now to a certain extent. There is a middle class emerging in China, a consumer class anyway. But the problem is that that doesn't help us in any way, because a living wage in China might be, let's say, $3,000-$4,000 a year. And people can actually live on that and live very comfortably on that, put their kids through school and everything, or $5,000, $6,000 a year. I don't know, but it's in that range. Whereas a living wage here in the United States is $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, probably minimally $30,000 a year. So every country has a standard of living, which is a function of the resources and wealth of that country internally and its ratio of labor to the demand for jobs. And every country decides that for themselves. And that's why I think we need to go back to a tariff-based system where you have that membrane of the legal system, of the tariff system. Because, the people who say, well, let's just pay everybody in the world American salaries, for example, American-level salaries, that won't work because there's not enough money in the world for that. There's 6 billion people out there, and half of them are living on a dollar a day, and 4 billion of them are living on $2 a day. Half the population of Mexico is living on less than $2 a day. You know, so it's just not practical. It's just something that we couldn't do. Mike in Tampa Bay, Florida. Hey, Mike, hang on. We'll pick you up on the other side of the break here. We've got to go to the break. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 45 minutes past the hour, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination and clean elections and national health care and maybe some politicians who tell the truth once in a while.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
My name's O.W. and for the woman's my heart. We hope you enjoy Shock and Awe. Halliburton's here to stay. No electricity today. Won't those in your blues away. My name is Rummy. How do you do? Have I got some mad tricks for you? What is knowable is that I'm full of gold. Bulldoze in your blues away.
And welcome back, my friends, to the place where smart people get their news. Tom Hartman here with you, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Mike in Tampa Bay, Florida. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Well, it's an honor to talk to you. You're the smartest man in radio.
Well, thank you, Mike.
So let me say, I've been in the agricultural industry down here in Florida for a little over 20 years. Mm-hmm. And when people say that people, you know, the Mexicans are the, you know, the illegal immigrants do work that Americans won't do, who did it 20 years ago?
Yeah, well, and who did it 30, 40 years ago? I can tell you, 30 years ago, I picked apples in northern Michigan. And my friend Dennis Weaver, he picked strawberries in Oregon for the better part of 5 years with his mother and his brother and his entire family. They were migrant workers. You know, but
when I used to go into the packing houses 20 years ago, most of the packers that were packing everything were white women, and they became black women, and now everybody's Hispanic. Mm. But when you go to Immokalee, which is the capital of the vegetable industry of Florida, they haven't raised the price per box that they pay the pickers in 12 years. They're paying them the same amount of money. So the real problem is that Americans would do the jobs. We did them before. We would do them again. It's not because we're too lazy. We're too stupid. It's just simply because the economic situation is stacked against the American worker.
Yeah, Mark, you're absolutely right.
Keep working, bud.
Okay, thanks a lot, Mike. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Greg in Sterling, Virginia. Hey, Greg.
Hey, how you doing? I was just flipping for channels, and guess what? I found a new station to listen to.
Oh, wonderful. So what's on your mind?
Well, actually, we immigrated from former Soviet Union back in 1979.
Mm-hmm.
And I was educated in this country. It absolutely offends me to no extent that people come here illegally. They commit felonies when they cross the border. And then they claim that they have rights.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's actually not a felony. It's a misdemeanor. But you make a good point. I mean, my sister-in-law right now is in the process of trying to become a U.S. citizen. I'm intimately familiar with how difficult the process, Greg, that you went through to become a U.S. citizen in all probability was. I mean, her process is probably going to take 5 years.
Yes, well...
And she's married to an American citizen.
That's exactly right. I've had a lot of friends who are in the same situation. But the other problem also is the fact that the companies... I used to hire illegals. I had a company in Southern California, a construction company. I was hiring the guys from 7-Eleven, from Home Depot, because they were cheap. They were working like dogs for $50 a day.
Right. Plus, there was no threat to you for doing it. There was no threat to you for doing it. And the point that I'm making is that, you know, people are demagoguing this thing on radio and television. They're saying, well, you know, where are you going to get all the, how are you going to spend $350 billion to arrest all these people and deport them? I'm saying, hey, if you start throwing employers in jail, you will have people saying, okay, enough of this. I can't get a job here. I'm going back home.
Tom, I totally agree with you because if I would have had a threat over my head of either financial or prison term, I would have never hired them, ever.
Yeah, nobody would. No right-thinking person would. And on the other hand, people in business, you have to make money. Otherwise, you know, somebody else is going to eat your lunch. They're going to take your business away from you.
If you can maximize on a contract, who wouldn't?
Yeah.
I had a company in Southern California for 12 years. But at the same time, I preferred all my guys that worked for me on a regular basis. I had 17 people working for me. Every one of them was either legal. A legal American citizen was born here.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you make a good point, Greg, and I appreciate your calling and making it. And people say, oh, but we have to be compassionate. I agree. And it is not compassionate to empower an oligarchy of 36 families that basically own Mexico and a corrupt former Coca-Cola executive, Vicente Fox, to continue running Mexico in a way that, and this is true of many South American, Central American countries, to continue running those countries in ways that have create desperate poverty. They need to solve their problems and not export them to us. Carol in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hey, Carol.
Hi, how you doing, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
All right. I thought that maybe if we stop the wire transfers to Mexico, which I understand is the greatest way that money is transferred from the United States into Mexico, if that were stopped, then how could these illegals come over here and work and get money back to their poor families in Mexico?
Well, then you would just, you know, just, it's sort of like, you know, trying to interdict drugs. As long as there's a demand, it's going to happen. It would just pop up someplace else. People would mail back checks. They would ultimately, if worse came to worse, they'd start converting their money into gold or diamonds and smuggling it back, you know, across the border. People would figure out a way to get it home. The thing to do is to stop the money being in their hands in the first place, which is to say that if you are illegal, you can't work here. And we as a nation have to have this national conversation about whether the 11 million people who are here illegally are going to be, number one, be told, sorry, you can't work here anymore, and then they're going to have to, you know, figure out how to get a bus ticket home if that's their choice. Or number two, make them legal, but make them legal fast in a way that doesn't give employers 6 years of life, you know, holding the prospect of life or death over their heads, because the employer has the ability to destroy their lives by saying, no, sorry, if I fire you, you have to go home. Ruth Ann in New Albany, Indiana. Hey, Ruth Ann, we just have a few seconds left.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. I just wanted to say I thought it was interesting last week I heard an INS official on NPR say that if we have this guest worker program, it is like opening the door to the race to the bottom for cheap labor, because
yeah,
there are people in countries other than Latin American countries that whose standard of living is low.
Who would work for even less? Absolutely. We have 6 billion people in the world, and 3 billion of them right now are living on $1 a day. You don't think there's a large pool of cheap labor out there? It's huge. And corporate America is salivating. They're just looking, going, oh, yeah, hey, emerging markets, cheap labor. This is a national discussion we need to be having, but we need to be having it without the demagoguery. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
So what kind of trade policy really does serve the interests of the citizens of the United States of America? What's really going to work for all of us? Daniel Eikenson is with us. He's with the Cato Institute, cato.org. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Great to have you. Senior Trade Policy Analyst with the Cato Institute Center for Trade Policy Studies. You wrote a piece about China recently, which I thought was interesting. In fact, at the end of it, there was a phrase in the summary where you said you referred to the administration's laudable efforts to keep the U.S.-China trade relationship on sound footing. What's laudable about this?
Well, there's a lot of impetus to intervene in the relationship and throw up trade barriers and to overreact in my view. This administration has recognized that there are broad benefits to our trade relationship with China.
To whom?
To U.S. consumers, to U.S. producers, to the world economy, the global economy benefits.
Why is it to a consumer's benefit to have access to cheap Chinese-made goods and yet not have a decent job?
Well, let's not oversell your point. I mean, we've got 4.7% unemployment in the United States, which is well below the average from the 80s and the 90s.
I don't consider having a job at Walmart any kind of decent job. I'm sorry.
Well, the people that work there find it to be a decent job. In fact,
they find it to be the only job they can get, Daniel Eikenson.
Well, you know, that may be the case for some people, but, you know, anytime a Walmart opens up, you have a lot of people applying to get jobs.
Walmart's average turnover is around 50% a year. You can't, you know, GM for years and years had a turnover rate of around 6%. You can't tell me that this is a good job.
Well, all I know is that the economy is doing quite well overall. We've had tremendous growth.
If you're a millionaire or a billionaire, people are doing well.
Well, I
mean,
if that's the story you want
let's
to
get down to the metrics here, Daniel. How do you define the economy? You say the economy is doing well. What I'm seeing is more people are in poverty now. More people are don't have health insurance. More people's unemployment has run out. That we have people more, you know, 40 years ago, most families, most American families could be supported by a single person working. Now it requires two people working. We have more people in the labor force. Yes, and you can say unemployment's down. I mean, if we were to use the exact same metrics that were used to measure unemployment the day that Ronald Reagan came into office, right now we'd have a 10.3% unemployment rate. And it just doesn't seem like the economy's doing all that well for anybody who's making under $100,000 a year, or really under around $500,000 a year.
Well, I'm evidence to the contrary. I make a lot less than that, and I'm doing pretty well. But do you want to talk about the trade relationship with China and why it's good? Providing products
sure.
that are accessible to Americans is a good
well,
thing.
Well, let me frame a question for you, and you know my bias
maybe
will be obvious.
Okay.
Yeah, my bias will be obvious in the frame, but you know nonetheless, it's a serious straight up question. In 1787, 2 years before the Constitution was ratified, Tench Coxe lobbied for and got passed through the you know what was then the U.S. Congress, more or less the operating Articles of Confederation, the first U.S. tariff law that specifically said in its title, for the protection of American industry.
Mm-hmm.
And the theory was that if a manufacturing a pair of shoes in the United States, there's a dollar's worth of labor in it, and you can manufacture that pair of shoes in England at the time, for example, with 10 cents worth of labor, then when those shoes are imported from England, there's going to be a 90-cent tax. Or if we're going to import something from China where those shoes might be 5 cents worth of labor, there'd be a 95-cent tax, a tariff, an import tariff.
Mm-hmm.
That was so successful in building American industry that, number one, it built American industry. We became the powerhouse of the world. This was how we defined our trade relationships right up until the 1980s, for over 200 years, number one. And number two, it was the sole source of revenue for the federal government right up until the Civil War. It was a third of our total government revenues up until World War I. It was a significant source of our revenues up until the 1980s. Why not simply go back to that? Why this free trade thing where Americans who used to be making $15, $20 an hour are now being forced to compete with people in China who are willing to work for 30 cents an hour, and so now we're finding, you know, average wages of $8, $9, $10 an hour at Walmart.
Okay. Is there a question?
Yeah, why? why not go back to a tariff-based system?
Because then you distort the market, you prevent companies from becoming competitive, you
that's
prevent
the whole
resources.
Point.
What's the point of that? Your economy can't grow like that.
The point of that is that you have decent paying jobs. And yes, your economy can grow. We did it for 200 years.
Yeah, but the pie doesn't grow. We grew in spite of our protectionism. You know, the circumstances were different. The world was basically closed off.
You could argue, Daniel, that the world grew in spite of our protectionism, but the United States grew because of our protectionism.
No, I doubt that. We grew because of our tremendous resources.
Why then is it that China has a 25% import tax on automobiles? But so if General Motors wants to import an auto into China, they have to pay a 25% import tax. And yet, if I want to import a car from China into the United States, it's only a 2% import tariff. China understands this. Japan understands this. Korea understands this. All these economies that are maintaining their heads above water, they all have import tariffs. Why shouldn't we?
We have import tariffs as well. Our average import tariffs are lower. Developing countries
around 2%.
On an applied basis, 1.6%. But we have tariff peaks, and those peaks are in products that are consumed disproportionately by America's working families, you know, clothing and shoes and foodstuffs that are produced by the developing countries of the world. We make it particularly hard on African farmers by subsidizing our cotton and peanut and sugar industry.
Well, I agree with you on that, and subsidies are a whole different thing. But if you're suggesting that our tariffs on clothing are high enough to keep textile jobs here in the United States, I just have to say, look around you. The textile mills all closed in the 80s and 90s when we did away with tariffs. And the only reason why we manufactured textiles in the United States from 1700 until the 1980s was because of tariffs.
Okay. Well, you know where these people went? Many of these people that were working in textile mills, the textile industry is still very, very strong in the United States. It's much more capital intensive than it was.
Which is another way of saying that the stuff is manufactured overseas and the industry is moving cash through.
It's a way of saying that the people that worked in these plants now have jobs working at BMW in South Carolina, at manufacturing plants. They've moved up the value chain. Yes, there are some people who have left and left.
So they work at BMW and the profit from their labor goes to Germany and not to the United States? That's a good thing?
This is not a very fun conversation. You don't entertain the facts. You're spinning off rhetoric
well,
and hyperbole that you've heard.
Correct me, Daniel. We have got about a minute left. I'll give it entirely to you.
Our trade relationship.
Actually, we have about 3 minutes left.
Okay. First of all, you said that we were protected through the 1980s. That's not true. After World War II, countries recognized that an open and integrated economy was going to be good for the world. And since then, we have been progressively lowering tariffs, as have our trading partners. That allows us to focus our resources on the things that we're most productive producing. The U.S. economy is in fabulous shape. It's a good thing that countries like China's have economies that are growing. Remember, before China emerged, the United States was really the only economy in the world that could be relied upon. Europe's economy has been moribund. Japan's economy has been moribund. It's important to have other centers of economic growth around the world.
But Daniel, in Europe and in Japan, and I lived in Europe for a year, and I did do business in Japan for the better part of a decade. In those countries, if you get sick, you get it well. You can go to any doctor, any hospital, and get taken care of.
What does it have to do with trade policy? What does it have to do with trade policy?
The whole point, and this is where I started this whole thing, is that countries establish trade policies to serve their people, not to serve their billionaires.
That is absolutely not what we do in this country either. Things would be unaffordable to Americans if we said, you know what, our mission is to make sure everybody has a high-paying job. If that were the case, then we would not be able to compete with anybody.
That's what we said in 1787.
We wouldn't be able to afford anything. In 1787, there were just a few economies in the world. Today, the world economy is integrated. We have internet. We have high-speed communications. We have transportation that connects the world in a second. So things are quite different than they were two centuries ago.
So then we're talking with Daniel Atkinson of the Cato Institute, cato.org. So you think that American laborers should simply compete with the other 6 billion people in the world without respect to national boundaries?
Yes. I think our laborers have an advantage. They're better educated. They have access to better capital. We have an education system here and a research and development system here that allows America to be the first producers of so many different products. So
for example?
It's not just on labor. Just on anything. In the auto industry, in the computer industry, aerospace.
We don't make computers in the United States anymore.
Well, we do. We make chips. We make things like that.
Assemble them here.
No, they're assembled abroad.
Well, Dell assembles down in Texas.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, the bottom line is that, I can't imagine that you disagree with this. I think that maybe, just like Lou Dobbs, you like to make an issue out of this.
No, I'm not being rhetorical. I'm being serious.
I think that you yourself would not be particularly well off if we had a country with 25% barriers across the board. You wouldn't be able to afford your lattes.
My father was, doing very well, and his generation and my grandfather's generation did very well when we had 25% tariffs.
Right. All right. Well, it was not a pleasure talking to you.
Okay. Daniel, thanks a lot for being with us. Daniel Atkinson, Cato.org. He's with the Cato Institution, a senior trade analyst, www.cato.org. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Say what you want, mean what you say. Remember the deepest seeds still find the light of day.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS. You can get the latest iPods and all things Macintosh. And EcoWine, the organic wine company, EcoWine.com, 1-888-ECOWINE, 1-888-ECOWINE. Call them and say hi. Ellen Ratner is with us with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Ellen.
Well, hi, and it's interesting. Mr. Bush is apparently, even though he's having bad polls, basically they are now saying that the president is going to make comments or make an argument publicly in the future weeks that Saddam Hussein decimated the political class in Iraq, and that is why there is not, that is why democracy is going to take time.
This is a variation on the it's all Clinton's fault argument.
Oh, exactly. And that, therefore, because there wasn't any political class in Iraq, there was no way to have a democracy. Well,
you know, just a second here. The Democrats, if they wanted to get out ahead of this, what they should be doing right now is they should be doing, as one, if you could imagine the Democrats turning like a school of fish, they should all be on all the talk shows right now talking about how the Reagan administration and the Bush administration, the first Bush administration, supported Saddam Hussein, armed Saddam Hussein, helped Saddam Hussein put down the rebellion, particularly the Shia rebellion in the South. They did it with our weapons, gave him the tools that he needed, trained his torturers, and helped him destroy the political class in Iraq. So then when Bush comes out and says, well, this is because Saddam destroyed the political class in Iraq, the message will be the Republicans helped him do that.
Right. I mean, you know, and what's so amazing is, look, he may be a dictator, but there is still a political class.
Oh,
there
sure.
were still people all over the country that were members of the Ba'ath Party, that went to political meetings, that were the town judges, were the town mayors.
Yeah.
I mean, so the fact that there's not a political class is just hogwash.
Well, the reality, the tragic reality, though, Ellen Renner, is that a lot of them are being murdered right now. I mean, that's these 5, 10, 15, 20 bodies a day with their hands tied behind their back and a bullet through their head. The two big pogroms that are going on right now inside Iraq are, number one, there's an organized campaign to murder gays. And that is not getting anywhere near enough publicity, in my opinion. But it has been sanctioned by the mullahs. And the second is that there is an organized campaign to murder the people who are politically active.
Well, of course, because they want there to be their, you know, they want to have the power. And unfortunately, we went in without having any direction at all about how this place was going to be run. Let me also suggest something, talk about something else, and that's there is a new White House Chief of Staff, Josh Bolton, and now he's looking at who's going to be Director of the Office of Management and the Budget. And apparently he is looking for an outsider, not an insider. They were hoping, a lot of people were saying they wanted Rob Portman to be it, but now it looks like they may go through an outsider because they want to start off on a new foot with members of Congress.
Plus they want somebody who's already had a lobotomy. Bad joke attempt, sorry.
Right. Also, just in terms of the upcoming elections, Harvard University came out, their Institute of Politics, with a study just today. It's been going around Washington that said that a lot of politicians are ignoring younger voters. And that there were 26.8 million 18 to 24-year-olds in 2000, 80% of the size of the senior populations, and that if people do that, they do that at their peril. One last thing, it looks like one of the right-wing magazines is actually saying now that they want the National Review, Catherine Harris, to abandon her Florida Senate bid for the good of the party.
Who are they going to replace her with at this late date?
I don't think anybody that we know of, but I think what they're hoping that they're going to get a state senator or somebody like that who has some name recognition in certain parts of the states. I think they know they're not going to win that seat.
Yeah.
They're very, I mean.
Well, in that case, they should just leave her in place, let her go down in flames, and then she'll be politically ignominious.
Well, I think they're hoping that they can put somebody in there that can at least damage the Democratic Party with their speeches, et cetera, so that at least that paves the way for some other very clear candidates for other offices.
Yeah, interesting.
So that is kind of interesting. And also, you know, my favorite issue is Hurricane Katrina.
Yes.
Homeland Security Secretary Chertoff said that now the government is on schedule to have these emergency response reforms in place by June 1st, which is the start of the hurricane season. I know we're not supposed to bet on the air, but if we were taking bets, my friend, it's not going to be pretty.
Well, in addition, it sounds like what he's saying is that by June 1st, he'll be able to begin dealing with Hurricane Katrina itself. I mean, we had a friend visiting over the weekend who lives down in Biloxi, Mississippi, and he said it's devastated down there, and they're getting nothing.
Right, exactly.
It's
still
a disaster.
Well, that's what, you know, you're going to be talking to Shirlene Espinoza shortly, and that's what that's about. But one last thing, the president said, I'm not through yet in terms of his leadership and what his agenda is, but a lot of people are saying in Washington, he can say anything he wants, he is as lame as a duck can be.
Right, he's toast politically. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Great website. Check it out. Ellen, thanks so much for being with
Thank
us today.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. And congratulations on your, whoop, she's gone, on her new bureau in New York. Welcome back. Yes, moving right along. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 27 minutes past the hour, the place where reason is our lifestyle choice.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
They say that Richard Corey owns one half of this whole town with political connections to spread his wealth around. Born into society, a banker's only child, he had everything a man could want, power, grace, style.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Sanity, my friends. Why some people put their credit cards in the microwave. Did I talk about this already? I thought I did. That was an amazing story. Anyway, let's go back to here. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, Ken in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Ken, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Great to talk to you. First off, was it the guy at the Ozark Society? The guy that was on the... talking to you earlier?
The Cato Society. Cato Institution.
Oh, okay, well, he sounds probably like the Ozark. The Cato Society, I think we should keep the immigrants and make him illegal and find a place for them.
No.
It's just ridiculous. That argument that a man can actually sit there and supposedly be an intelligent individual and think that people are happy to work at Walmart and
these are the,
a good life.
Ken, these are the people who advise George W. Bush.
Well, yeah, I'm sure they all think alike.
I'm dead serious. This is the Cato Institute.
Yeah,
these are the people. These are the people who advise the Republican Party.
Well,
these
they all believe this. They believe that this guy was spewing, and it's just so ridiculous.
And
we're in a good economy right now.
And you know, first of all, I have to say, I didn't have an opportunity to say it to him because he hung up at the very end there. But I am grateful to him for coming on the program, and I do appreciate it when people who disagree with me come on the program, and I will give them an opportunity to say their piece. I mean, you know, I think it's just an absolutely critical thing. But at the same time, his rebuttal to me that I was not making him happy. I'm sorry. There are kids in hock for college studying for degrees that are getting that are being sent overseas. I mean, that are competing with people who are coming from overseas. That their degree is going to be worthless because of the increase in the H-1B visas or because of my illegal immigrants or because companies can outsource things. I mean, what good is an engineering degree anymore? Those kids are not happy.
I know I've got limited time. I called because I had a different view on this immigration thing.
Sure.
All right, first thing, you've made this point a million times on your program that there would be no immigration problem if companies offered a decent wage. There are millions of Americans that are willing to grab a good job.
Yeah.
And the problem still is that the haves aren't willing to part with their profits. These guys are making huge amounts of profits while people are losing their jobs or companies are asking their employees to take, a 50% pay cut, threatening their benefits, threatening
Social
Security. And, if anybody that's ever read Howard Zinn's People's History know that this has been going on forever. Every time that people start questioning the wealth, they start turning the argument to the people that are fighting for the scraps. It's not us. It's those people that are taking your jobs away from you. It's them over there. It's not us. The problem is the people that are taking your jobs that are willing to work for less. No, the problem is the billionaires and the guys with all the money aren't willing to part with their tax cuts. They aren't willing to give up their 50, 60, 70-foot yachts. Because there are people out here that have to make a decision: do I buy food or do I buy medicine? And we got an administration that thinks that they got to start anteing up.
Yep.
The people on welfare and Social Security got to start paying their fair share. Well, they're paying more than their fair share. They can't make it.
Right. And at what point do we start even saying things like motherhood or parenthood is worthy of recognition and worthy of retirement with Social Security and health insurance, for example? Now, this is, Ken, what you have identified is where I will say what the conservatives say I will say, and they say it with great horror. You will hear Limbaugh and all these other right-wing guys come out here saying, the liberals, they want to redistribute wealth in this country. And yes, that is what I am saying. And that is the purpose of progressive taxation.
I don't want to take their money. I don't want to take their house away from them. I just want to take a little bit of that money they got stocked in some bank, where they're drawing interest.
Well, it's not even that, Ken. What it is at a certain point you say, people, yes, we want to encourage people to be entrepreneurs. We want to encourage people to make money. It's fine if people become multimillionaires in our society. However, as users of the commons, the more wealth people are accumulating, the more heavily they are using the commons, and the more heavily they are using the commons, our court systems, our education system, and you say, but I only have one child, and this billionaire only has one child in college. Yes, but all of your employees are the products of public education. The more heavily they're using the commons, the more they should pay in as a percentage in their taxes. And I'm not suggesting that we should do a communist-style redistribution of wealth where everybody ends up with the same. That's not my suggestion. But yes, I think that this is the point at which government intervention is necessary. Otherwise, you have what the French refer to as savage capitalism, where you have basically a small, elite, powerful ruling class and a whole lot of poverty-stricken and terrified worker bees and nothing in between. There is no middle class. And that is not the American ideal. That is not the American dream. That's Dickinson's England. And that's the world that the conservatives want to take us back to. Because the natural state of an economy, if it's run as laissez-faire capitalism, the natural state of a laissez-faire capitalism economy will always destroy the middle class without the intervention of the middle class itself, without the intervention of the people themselves, government, using the power of government. And yes, it's a terrible power, as George Washington said, it's like a fire, it can burn. And it, needs to be restrained. I mean, look at George W. Bush putting people in prison without even charges, Jose Padilla, because he was surfing the web and, looked at a dirty bomb site. Oh, put him in prison for 3 years. The power of government is a fearsome thing. And we the people need to, on the one hand, tightly hold the reins over it, and on the other hand, or at the same time, also use it to serve the public good. And call me a Democrat if you want. I'll take that. Tom in Minneapolis. Hey, Tom.
Well, again, we've seen this movie before. It's called The Republican Great Depression. I mean, we've seen the movie.
Yeah. And that's what they're heading us for. I'm telling you, gold is over $600 an ounce. Oil is pushing $70 a barrel. And these are not copper went from 70 cents a pound when Bush came into office. It's $2.60 a pound now. And what all these things tell us, Tom, is not that the price of commodities is going up. It's that the value of the dollar is going down. And this is the marketplace of the world. These are the traders, the millionaires and billionaires of the world who deal in these commodities, and the people who have control over these commodities saying to us by their actions, not their words, that they no longer have confidence in the United States. And when that becomes explicit, we are toast.
Right. And I just wanted to mention, I think it's great that you always play these audio clips of former presidents, because that's all we need to do is just play these speeches of how politicians and leaders used to speak, bluntly, to the point. And I wanted to bring up FDR's speech regarding employers. And basically, I know you don't like reading quotes here, but here's a quickie two-sentence quote from Franklin Roosevelt saying, "No business which depends for existence on paying less than living wages to its workers has any right to continue in this country. By living wages, I mean more than a bare subsistence level. I mean wages of a decent living." And that's what he said. And you don't hear politicians say that.
It was Franklin Roosevelt. And in that, he was echoing his distant, distant cousin, Teddy Roosevelt, who invented the phrase living wages.
Exactly. And I always say to these guys, well, I'd go out of business if I had to pay, higher wages. And I say to them, then you're not a viable business. Get in line with every other employee.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. The magnet is the illegal employers. That's what is, like you always say, that's the key.
Yeah, well said. Thank you very much, Tom.
Good to
hear from you.
December 7th, 1941.
This is not the clip I thought it was. Anyway, we'll move on. Evan in Bellevue, Washington. Hey, Evan, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how's it going? I just wanted to say that Mr. Cato is a real jerk.
And he didn't answer any of your questions, and every time he brought up a point, you answered his questions.
Well, I don't think he was a real jerk. I think he was a really brave guy to come on this program with me. And again, I hope that he will come back again. And you know, I would love to have the question that I would have asked if we'd had more time was, please name for me one country that has followed your economic policies and seen their middle class grow.
Well, the point is what they want. They kicked all the people off welfare who they think didn't deserve it, and then they took all the money themselves.
Yeah.
It's corporate welfare. That's what we do these days. And then the other thing on the immigration issue, you know, Americans don't want to pay what it costs to make food at this point. And not that I don't agree with a lot of what you're saying, to raise those wages, you know, the business owners are not going to take a cut in their percentage of profits in order to support the living wage.
Right.
We have to, as Americans, pay for the American-produced goods.
No, I agree, and that's
and
what we did, by the way.
Right,
I mean, in 1950, we were in 1960, we were buying Levi's that were made in the United States. We were buying shoes that were made in the United States. Yes, they cost a little more, but our paychecks were much larger.
But the catch-22 is, how do you get over that hump? How do you get from where you can afford your job pays enough that you can pay for the American-made good? Do you see what I'm saying?
Oh, sure. And the bottom line is, an economy is going in one direction. An economy is going in one direction or the other. It is either moving toward higher wages for workers and lower, ultimately, lower CEO salaries, or it's going toward lower wages for workers and higher profits and higher CEO salaries. And in the United States, for a long time, we had CEOs who were earning 30, 50, 100 times what their employers were, what their workers were making, and now they're making 500 times what their workers are making, and the workers are stuck in a rut. And in large part, it is because of these policies. As Dan Eikenson pointed out, because, for example, our textile industry in the United States has become essentially a financial industry. It's become it's become monetized. It is all about moving money from country to country and moving goods from country to country rather than hiring people in the United States. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
One day you'll look to see I've gone, for tomorrow may rain, so I'll follow the sun.
1,014 days, 11 hours, 10 minutes, 52 seconds, till George W. Bush leaves office, barring an impeachment that might speed up the process. Geraldine in Sacramento, California. Hey, Geraldine, thank you for calling.
Well, I just called to ask you, what's the solution? I grew up in the Depression. I'm an old lady. And I see these things happening, and it brings me to tears.
Mm.
My husband and worked in the construction industry. We thought life was grand because we had union wages and we saved our little bits of money and took care of our family, and we thought that life was really good, and I cannot believe what's happening.
Yeah, well, Geraldine, you'll recall when Franklin Roosevelt started out in the Great Depression, you said you're a child of the Great Depression, when he first said,
I see one-third of a nation ill-housed, ill-clad, ill-nourished.
And then he went on to talk about the importance of government intervention.
Better the occasional fault of a government that lives in a spirit of charity than the consistent omission of a government frozen in the ice of its own indifference.
And that's where I'd say we're at, Geraldine, right now, is we have a government, basically starting with Ronald Reagan, that believed in frozen indifference. These guys don't believe in government, and therefore they can't govern.
But
and
how are we going to fix it?
We need another Franklin Roosevelt.
Well, we do, but I don't see anybody on the horizon.
I think there are a few out there. I think that John Edwards could be that person. I think that Howard Dean could be that person. I think that Russ Feingold could be that person. I think Barbara Boxer could be that person.
Well,
and you never know.
Excuse
me.
when we were, my husband and I were young, he has died last year, we had, my father was in the hospital for 30 days, and we had saved some money with some idea that we'd go into business one day. And we took our savings, and we could pay for 30 days of hospitalization for my father and funeral bills. Mm-hmm. You think about a working man being able to do that today. Just consider that it's just a great impossibility.
Yes.
Why is that?
And that's, well, because Bill Frist's father is now a multi-billionaire. Because people in the health industry are making profits, record profits, profits that have never been seen before in this country. And nobody is restraining them. Nobody is stopping them. Nobody is saying enough already.
But is the American public so dumb, and I hate to say that, that they're going to keep on with this? I just can't believe that they're going to keep allowing these people free reign to choke our country to death where you can't. And when they say jobs people won't do, I almost come unglued. My husband poured curb and gutter down this Central Valley for years. He couldn't even take his shoes off. He'd be so tired. And they talk about him not... You know, like lazy.
Mm-hmm. I hear you, Geraldine. No, in answer to your question, are the American people going to wake up? I think the American people are waking up, and I think that, you know, the Roosevelt, again, to quote him, you know, there's a mysterious cycle to human events, and I think that the cycle is, I think that there actually is a cycle. I think history does repeat itself, and we are coming back around. I think the American people are waking up. Geraldine, I've got to move along. Thank you so much for calling in today. It's great to hear from you. I appreciate it. David in Bainbridge, Washington. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Concerning possible candidates, what about Mark Warner, the ex-governor of Virginia?
I don't know much about him, and I've never met him, and I've frankly never even heard a story. But apparently, a lot of Democrats are very impressed by him. I don't know. And frankly, I have to say, I think that anybody has the potential to become Franklin Roosevelt. Let's keep in mind, in 1932, when Franklin Roosevelt ran against Herbert Hoover, he ran on a fairly conservative ticket. He was not proposing things like Social Security or the Wagner Act, you know, unionization or the WPA. He didn't talk about any of that stuff. He ran as basically a very conservative Democrat, a status quo Democrat, and the main reason he won in 32 was because people just didn't buy Herbert Hoover's campaign slogan, which was prosperity's right around the corner, and it wasn't until he got into power, Franklin Roosevelt, and he started, you know, playing with the levers of government and seeing how things could change, that he started realizing, you know, what he could do. I'm not convinced that somebody who is relatively conservative like Hillary Clinton could become the next Franklin Roosevelt. Sorry to cause the coughing fit there by mentioning Hillary's name, but I think that...
Yeah, well, I called about it, Bush.
Yeah.
When they first, President Bush said, when the Valerie Plame leak came out, he said, that's a treasonous act. Has anyone asked him now if he still thinks it's treason that his son is the one who did the leaking?
Yeah, well, nobody's asked him. Actually, he didn't say it was a treasonous act when it first happened, and thanks for the call, David. He said that back when he was vice president, I believe. And talking about outing of a CIA agent, it was in another context, but he did pretty explicitly say it and unambiguously say it. And I think it's an important lesson for all of us.
We're not a warlike people.
Franklin Roosevelt.
We've never sought glory as a nation of warriors. We're not interested in aggression. We are not interested, as the dictators are, in looting. We do not covet one square inch of the territory of any other nation.
So the question we are all facing, and I think it's a very serious and very real question, is where is the next Franklin Roosevelt going to come from? Where is, and it's going to come, I'm telling you, it's going to come from us. It's going to come. Franklin Roosevelt didn't invent himself. Franklin Roosevelt was a product of the times, and he was a product of the fact that people were supporting his reforms. When he came forward with these reforms, people said, yes, we like that. In fact, they reelected him 3 times. This guy was president of the United States 4 different times. The Republicans were so freaked out by it, they passed a constitutional amendment to say that nobody could run for president more than twice. Then they started regretting that during the Reagan years. But in any case, it was the power of the people that made Roosevelt possible. That's you and me, my friends. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you. Founded in 1990, Bioneers is a nonprofit organization that promotes practical environmental solutions and innovative social strategies for restoring the earth and communities. Bioneers.org, their website. And our Bioneers guest for this week, Abigail Ayling. Am I pronouncing that right, Abigail?
Abigail Alling, yes.
Alling, sorry. I'm sorry. Abigail Alling, she is the co-founder and CEO and president of Planetary Coral Reef Foundation, PCRF, PCRF.org, the website, actively engaged in marine, environmental, and closed systems research for 23 years. You were one of the eight biospherians who lived inside for 2 years inside Biosphere 2?
Yes, I was.
That must have been a remarkable experience.
It was extraordinary, a life-changing experience.
Yeah, and in fact, I'd love to ask you about that, although I think that first, this coral reef stuff that you're working on, the Planetary Coral Reef Foundation, founded in 1991, you have this ship, the RV, is it
Heraclitus.
Heraclitus,
thank you. After the Greek philosopher.
Heraclitus.
Yeah.
I'm displaying my ignorance here of Greek philosophers, or at least how to pronounce their names. In any case, in November of 2004... the Heraclitus sailed to the remote Phoenix Islands, supposedly among the most pristine islands on the planet, and you made a shocking discovery.
Yes, well, the last piece of literature or information on these islands prior to our arrival there was a National Geographic article in February of 2004 with scientist David Oberoi and others who had gone there and found that these were the last remaining pristine reefs that they thought were left in the world. And we went there to see this exquisite site, and when we arrived there in November, December of 2004, with quite some shock, the crew discovered that the lagoon in Canton, one of the islands, was 100% dead. The corals had died due to global warming.
Mm. And 60% mortality on the leeward side of the island.
That's right. And
now, what is the mechanism by which global warming kills coral reefs?
Well, in this particular case, since the Phoenix Islands are so remote and there's no industry out there, there's no tourism out there, you know, a handful of 40 to 50 people live on the island that have been living their lives, there's really no explanation for how such massive mortality could have occurred in such a short order, except that NOAA posts on their webpage, hotspots they're called, these are sea surface temperature, unprecedentedly high and persistent water temperatures that sat over the island for about 8 months. And after that period of time, we can only surmise that that's how they died.
Mm. So the higher temperatures, coral normally lives between 78 and 82 degrees, and
that's
the assumption
right.
is the temperature got above 82. And now the coral is an animal, right?
It's an animal and a plant. It has a symbiotic relation.
Right. There's an algae that lives on the... So coral itself is a description of multiple organisms living symbiotically.
That's right. And they're the limestone producers. They grow producing limestone, and the algae pulls CO2 out of the water, providing oxygen, and the little coral partly feeds on the algae and also filter feeds elsewhere. So
right, and then takes that carbon and produces the carbon reefs, the carbonate
right.
reefs.
Yeah.
And so the higher temperatures apparently are hostile not so much to the animal inside the coral, but to the algae.
Yeah, that's what scientists think, is that the little zooplankton, zooxanthellae they're called, that are living inside the tissue, react due to the high temperature and flee. And then it's either a chance whether the coral will regrow itself or the zooxanthellae will come back into the coral or not. And so it's a very fragile dynamic, and many, many studies have shown that this kind of heating of water and persistent heating of water will, in fact, eventually kill the corals.
Abigail Alling, co-founder and president of the Planetary Coral Reef Foundation, PCRF.org. Why is it important to us? You know, here we are,
you know, inland, most of us, and not, you know, making our living off coral reefs, et cetera, you know. Why is the survival of coral reefs around the planet important to humans?
Well, right now, coral reefs provide about 10% of the world's diet. They're also home to 25% of fish species. They protect coastlines of at least 109 countries. They generate $375 billion in annual revenue, it's estimated. They are also, from our point of view, a key indicator of the health of our oceanic environment and hence our little biosphere or our world at large. Mm-hmm. And if they are dying across the world or in demise, which right now 25% of the world's reefs have been estimated to have died, and two-thirds could be at risk, this is an enormous sign. This is, you know, a red flag waving under sea from this little environment, the coral reefs, that are important to our health and well-being and are important as an indicator to the health of our biosphere, saying, help!
would it be an exaggeration to say that our planet, and by this I don't mean the ball of dirt that's flying through space, but the biological system that we refer to as our planet, the livingness of Earth, which includes inorganic material as well, that our planet is dying?
Well, I mean, that is a stretch, but I do think that the little coral reef is an indicator of the health, and because we're seeing, and others are seeing too, we're not the only ones out there looking and studying coral reefs, everyone is agreeing that this is a real estimate that we're all arriving at, is that two-thirds of these reefs are at risk, and that 25% have already disappeared, and that this means something is up.
Aren't coral reefs also one of the major carbon sinks on our planet?
Yes, they are. The carbon is sequestered into the limestone, and this is a study that scientists are quite intrigued and engaged with, of course, is what is the relationship compared to the rainforest and how much carbon is being sequestered, and that is certainly a part of the overall balance, yes.
Hmm. So what can we do about this?
Well, what we're doing at Planetary Coral Reef Foundation, because the task is very daunting, is we provide on our homepage, www.pcrf.org, information about what's happening that we are seeing around the world. Our little ship is out there with an international team of 14 constantly surveying reefs and posting that information online. We have about 26 sites out there now. You can go review the data and take a look at what they're finding. We also are posting now videos, both about coral reefs and the cultures that are also facing this tragic loss along the coast. And we also have expedition logs and dive logs posted. So we're trying to tackle this problem through information by getting people virtually to tour with us around the world, getting underwater through our website, and hopefully by more information, including this radio talk show, that people will realize we have a problem and rise to the occasion to make a difference.
Wake people up and send them to PCRF.org. Abigail Allen, I'm curious. We have about 2 minutes left. What was it like living for 2 years inside Biosphere 2 with 8 other people, basically in a very closed environment? What was the most difficult part? What was the most rewarding part? And what did you not expect that you discovered?
Well, Biosphere 2 was one of these moments that happened in your lifetime that you constantly reflect back on, and not really only reflect, it's such a part of who I am right now that it's changed everything I'm doing, including what I'm doing with Planetary Coral Reef Foundation. We found inside Biosphere 2 that the little coral reef was truly the indicator of the health of Biosphere 2, and by monitoring it daily, we would be able to better help manage our little biosphere, and that's hence the work I'm doing. So I see things from a planetary perspective, which is, I think, what we all need to do. We do live on a planet. We are all one people on the planet. And one of the highest moments of Biosphere 2, no matter how difficult it got with the 8 people inside, was the fact that all 8 could come together with the task of taking care of their biosphere and loving the biosphere, and that brought us together no matter what. And that's a very hopeful and beautiful story.
One of the persistent myths of our culture, and I think of most cultures that have salvationistic religions at their core, is the idea that people are fundamentally evil and they will fundamentally screw things up if given an opportunity. And I think of this as a cultural myth, and it is a dysfunctional cultural myth. But living with 8 people for 2 years in a closed environment, I suspect you might have some insight into that.
Well, I think there's many ways to skin a cat, and there's many ways to view, you know, ways to proceed in one's life, and I think this is always the origin of conflict and difficulties. But it doesn't mean anyone's evil, and I think particularly with regards to biosphere too, yes, there's many differing views about how to operate the biosphere or what was most important, most significant, where one's attention should be placed, et cetera. But these are issues we all face, and really, again, the overlying theme for us in there, and I think for us here on this planet, is really to tackle the health of our biosphere. If our biosphere is well, we are well. And that is such an enormous task at hand that sort of brings all conflicts to a different point of view. And no matter what, we can come together and come together because we all, in essence, have that interest in our hearts and minds.
That seems to be another human fundamental, only one that's, I think, true, and that is that when we're confronted with something larger than ourselves, we rise to the occasion, we pull together.
Yeah.
Abigail Alling, PCRF.org, the Planetary Coral Reef Foundation. Abigail, thanks so much for being with us.
Wonderful
today.
To talk to you. Thank
and,
you.
And for the great work you're doing. And,
thank you very much.
I salute you for it. 16 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartmann radio program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartmann.
And I'm taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you bounced Iraq. So I'm taking
it's our Taking My Country Back segment, my friends.
We had a bundle in the treasury drawer, more than there had ever been before. But every day we're down in deeper in debt.
And we're going to be taking our Taking Our Country Back, Taking My Country Back segment here every week. We want to have on candidates and politicians who have succeeded in their candidacies and who can provide a solid progressive model for us. We have with us Mark Begich. He's the mayor of Anchorage, Alaska. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on.
Great to have you here. The website, muni.org. And, Mark, Anchorage, Alaska, I understand. My wife has been there. I have not, but...
Well, you need to come up here one of these times.
I would love to. I absolutely would love to. I mean, we're on the air there. Hopefully we can do a remote from there sometime. But I understand it's a relatively politically conservative town, and you're a relatively progressive guy. How did you succeed in winning an election in a conservative area?
Well, you know, 3 years ago I ran against the incumbent, and we ran a pretty grassroots campaign and really just involved as many people as we could. I was outspent back then 3 years ago almost 4-1, 5-1, and it was the first time we actually beat in this city an incumbent that had 15 years of Republican control of the city. And then the reelection that occurred, we won with almost a 15% margin, which in this community would be a landslide. And
in any community, that's
in any community, right? And it was a pretty, you know, we had not only our opponent who had some money, but the Republican Party was spending money, special interest groups were spending money against us, and we just focused on the message of what I did for the last 3 years, and then a very positive message. Amazingly, this is now the second time the two elections we have not, you know, campaigns sometimes you have to end up running some corrective ads, I call it. Now, some people might call them negative ads, but we didn't do any of that. We just ran a positive ads about the great city we live in, the opportunities we've done. And in the last 3 years, I've focused on issues of public safety, economic development, and then making government more efficient. And those were kind of the pieces in it. But I think probably the most important part was I spent a lot of my time the last 3 years out in the community talking with folks, building coalitions, and trying to figure out, you know, what those issues are and taking action on them and being very straightforward. I mean, when I've made a mistake in the last 3 years, I get out there and I tell the community, We don't hide from the mistakes we make. We get out there, we say it, and we engage the community. And I think the voters all across this country, it doesn't matter if it's local elections, state elections, federal elections, they want their elected officials to be straightforward with them, and no matter if it's bad news. And,
yeah.
And I think, you know, we see that on the national end right now where some aren't being as straightforward, and public may not always agree with you, but they appreciate leadership that's going to be honest with them, even if they don't like the message, you know what I mean? It's,
yep.
It's, and I think that's what we've done, and I think we saw a strong payoff in this election in a very conservative town.
Mark Begich, the B-E-G-I-C-H, the mayor of Anchorage, Alaska, the website muni.org/mayor/. And Mayor Begich, I'm curious, did your opponent go negative on you?
Yeah, at the very end, they standard classic attack, they had just phrases out there, beat Begich. It wasn't even about him anymore. It was beat me with big 4x8 signs up, and how I'm running the city down, down the drain. I had the liquor industry arguing against me on his behalf with full half-page ads. So last 2 weeks was classic. It's the classic campaign where they come and beat you over the head.
Mark, we only have about a minute and a half left. I'm curious, what's your advice to people who might be thinking of running for office as progressives, even, particularly in conservative areas, and to those candidates who are running?
I think the issue that they need is to pick those types of issues that are, family-oriented, financial in a certain way. Public safety is always a great issue. Every community needs better public safety, and focused on those kind of family issues that people, we find ourselves as progressives always on this higher plane, and you got to be careful about that. You got to bring it down and talk about the real issues that matter to people everyday life. And also, be very straightforward. If you make a mistake, you say it. You take the blame for it. Because
now that's completely contrary to political wisdom.
Oh, absolutely. Most political people will tell you, do the two-step and dance around it. What I have found is just tell them when you make a mistake and be honest about it. But at the same time, acknowledge that you've learned from it and you want to move forward. And I think I hear it over and over again from people. They say, we may not always agree with you, but we like the fact that you're willing to engage people, be honest about it, and you'll engage all sides of the equation. I would recommend that. And then grassroots, get every single body you can think of working the campaign.
Get as many people out there organized as possible.
Absolutely.
Mark Begich, the mayor of Anchorage, Alaska, and we're on KUDO in Anchorage, Alaska. So pleased to have you with us, Mayor Begich. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Congratulations on your victories, and thanks for being a role model to progressives all across the country.
It's
27 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
What do you call a tax cut for the wealthiest 1%?
Homeland Security.
What do you call the other 99 who can't make the rent?
Homeland Security.
A lovely little bit of phraseology for all the neocon men when they announce a massive deficit, something that they consider preficit. What do you call the cable guy who's rifling through your mail?
Homeland Security.
What do you call it when you get arrested for clipping a nail?
Homeland Security.
Two little words that mean a shocking
campaign. Welcome back,
campaign.
My friends.
34
minutes past the hour. Coming up on 25 minutes before the top of the hour. There is an amazing clip, and it's being played by a lot of shows and a lot of people out here. But I suspect that most who are playing it are—this is a clip of President George W. Bush being asked a question by a first-year student at—I don't have the name of the university, wherever he was speaking in the last 24 hours here. And I think that most people hearing this clip will miss the bigger picture. So I want to play the clip for you and then provide a context that you may not have considered.
Thank you, Mr. President. It's an honor to have you here.
Thanks.
I'm a first-year student in South Asia Studies. My question is in regards to private military contractors. The Uniform Code of Military Justice does not apply to these contractors in Iraq. I asked your Secretary of Defense a couple months ago what law governs their actions. Mr.
I was going to ask him. Go ahead. Help.
Well, I was hoping your answer might be a little more specific. Mr. Rumsfeld answered that Iraq has its own domestic laws, which he assumed applied to those private military contractors. However, Iraq is clearly not currently capable of enforcing its laws, much less against, you know, over our American military contractors. I would submit to you that in this case, this is one case that privatization is not a solution. Mm. And Mr. President, how do you propose to bring private military contractors under a system of law?
Yeah, I appreciate that very much. I wasn't kidding. I pick up the phone and say, Mr. Secretary, I got an interesting question. This is what delegation, I don't mean to be dodging the question, although it's kind of convenient in this case, but never. I really will. I'm going to call the secretary and say, you brought up a very valid question, and what are we doing about it? That's how I work. Thanks.
Yeah. Now the easy take on this is that's how I work. I'm incompetent. I don't know about, that's the easy take. The big picture, though, the real story here is about privatization, because this is an administration which has made privatization their religion. This goes all the way back to Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan started this whole thing with this whole cult of government bashing, the idea that a government of, by, and for we the people can do no right, that government is the fundamental evil because government is the thing that stands in the way of the, who is John Galt, of the noble capitalists, that government, the government is somehow a terrible force, as Reagan said.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And it was, a laugh line that never failed to work for Reagan. And I suspect a lot of people down in Mississippi and Alabama right now are not laughing. The reality is that if you don't believe in government, you can't govern. And George W. Bush does not believe in government. And Don Rumsfeld does not believe in government. And Dick Cheney does not believe in government. And Condoleezza Rice does not believe in government. In fact, I would say probably the only member of the Bush administration over the last 5 years who believed in government was Colin Powell. And they got rid of him. And they booted his ne'er-do-well son off the head of the FCC in punishment for his not going along with the party line, even though he has managed to keep his mouth shut. There was a time, starting in the very earliest days of this republic, and extending certainly up through, I would submit to you, in all probability, up through the 1980s anyway. I don't know exactly when the dismantling of our American military began. My guess is that it began under Reagan, the privatization of our military. Dismantling is probably the wrong word, because we're throwing more and more money at the military, but we're doing it in different ways. What we're doing is we're throwing money at private corporations. But there was a time from the founding of the military until relatively recently when the military was self-sufficient. When in the Army you had PX, you pulled PX duty, you peeled potatoes, you cooked food, you mopped floors, you've mopped the bathrooms, you've cleaned out the urinals and the toilets. I mean, you did everything. That was, sometimes it was punishment, sometimes it was just your job, but the Army did everything. And what the Bush administration has done, and not just the Bush administration, what the conservatives, starting with Ronald Reagan, the anti-government, anti-democracy conservatives, what they have done from that point, from the time in the 1980s when they really got some traction and really rose up and took over this country, or large sectors of it, what they have done with, for example, our military. This is a metaphor for everything else, all the other branches of government, all everything else that's happening, whether you're looking at our national parks or whether you're looking at our energy infrastructure. I mean, look at, you know, California going down in flames because of deregulation, because Enron was allowed to go in there and manipulate California. Whether, you know, whether you're looking at water supplies that are no longer safe, whether you're looking at our food supply, which is questionable in places, you know, mad cow disease emerging, whether you're looking at our pharmaceuticals, and, you know, now we've got pharmaceutical billionaires, and in the meantime, people dying from drugs. I mean, you know, no matter where you look at the commons, our education system, our school systems that are privatized with No Child Left Behind, where schools are required to buy from private corporations tests that cost a fortune. When back in the old days, you know, back in the day, the teachers used to just write the test up, run it off on the mimeo machine, didn't cost anything. Now there's a profit margin in there for Neil Bush. Anyhow, the way it used to be in the Army is it used to be self-sufficient. It did everything. And the cons came along and they said, let's privatize this thing. Let's privatize as much of it as we can. And so now we have Halliburton serving food to our troops in Iraq. And we, those of you who are longtime listeners to this program, you'll recall it was almost 2 years ago. We had a mother on, one of the members of Cindy Sheehan's organization, Gold Star Mothers for Peace, as I recall. In any case, we had a mother on this program whose son died in Iraq. He was stationed, he was with the U.S. Army. He was stationed in Iraq. And he died traveling the road from Baghdad to the Baghdad airport to collect his mail. Now, why did he travel to the Baghdad airport to collect his mail? Because Halliburton, which had been given the job of delivering the mail, or Kellogg Brown and Root, the Halliburton subsidiary that reincorporated offshore so they in the Cayman Islands so that they wouldn't have to pay U.S. taxes, KBR decided on that particular week that that road was too dangerous for them to ask their employees to carry the mail into Baghdad, into the Green Zone, and out to the front lines to the U.S. Army soldiers. And so they said, if you want your mail, you've got to come out to the airport and get it. And he went out to the airport to get it along with a couple of friends of his, and they died. Used to be the mail was delivered by soldiers to soldiers. The Army had its own internal post office. It had its own internal everything. And now, as a consequence of this privatization, here comes this amazing story in today's Los Angeles Times. Paul Watson wrote this. I'm just going to read the first couple paragraphs straight up. No more than 200 yards from the main gate of the sprawling U.S. base here. This is Bagram Air Force Base, Afghanistan. No more than 200 yards from the main gate of the sprawling U.S. base here, stolen computer drives containing classified military assessments of enemy targets, names of corrupt Afghan officials, and descriptions of American defenses are on sale in the local bazaar. Shop owners of the bazaar say Afghan cleaners, Afghan garbage collectors, and other workers from the base arrive each day offering purloined goods, including knives, watches, refrigerators, packets of Viagra, flash memory drives taken from military laptops. The drives, smaller than a pack of chewing gum, are sold as used equipment. A reporter recently obtained several drives at the bazaar that contained documents marked secret. The contents included documents that were potentially embarrassing to Pakistan, a U.S. ally, presentations that named suspected militants targeted to kill or capture, and discussions of U.S. efforts to remove or marginalize Afghan government officials whom the military considered problem makers. The drives, now keep in mind, these are hard drives that they bought 200 yards from the base, from the front gate of the base. They bought this at a local bazaar, a local flea market. These reporters went up and bought a hard drive and read it. After choosing the name, the drives also included deployment rosters and other documents that identified nearly 700 U.S. service members and their Social Security numbers. After choosing the name of an Army captain at random, a reporter using the Internet was able to obtain detailed information on the woman, including her home address in Maryland and the license plate numbers of her 2003 Jeep Liberty Sport utility vehicle and 1998 Harley-Davidson XL883 Hugger motorcycle. And this article goes on for 4 pages about all the information they got on this drive. Why? Because we privatized base security. We privatized base cleaning. We privatized the meals. What this religion of privatization is destroying America. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Till the next time, say goodbye. Till the next time, say goodbye.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. A place where despair is not an option. Get active! Larry in Washington State on the line. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Larry. Hi, Tom. Listen, you know, your metaphor that you began the show with today, it's that Cato shill using the cellular membrane, that was a great one. I mean, it reminded me of Adam Smith and Hume and Montesquieu and then all the contributors to Wealth of Nations. They were more like moral philosophers than economic theorists, right? They had they never intended this invisible hand to apply to labor.
Well, and in fact, if the phrase "invisible hand" only appears once in Wealth of Nations, and in that context, you could argue that Adam Smith was using it in the context of a warning.
Well, I mean, they had a plan for. I mean, the race to the bottom was easy to see, right? So their plan was, and they used the same metaphor basically, of absolute balanced trade within political borders, like within your membrane.
Right.
So if you needed something, you had to import something, you had to create something to export to make room in the equation, or produce it yourself, or innovate some alternative to this thing. And all of those create.
And the other point, I mean, the example that they used, and it's been 30 years since I've read Wealth of Nations, and it was hard enough the first time because it's very turgid, you know, very dense reading. But my recollection is that the metaphor they used was, if you've got a country that produces good cheese and you've got a country that produces good wool, and you've got the cheese is a result of the particular type of cows or bacteria they've got, another country that produces a particular kind of wool because they've got land that's good for sheep, and another country that produces good wine because they have good vineyards, then those three countries should be trading with each other so that all three of them can have cheese, wine, and you know, they can sit there in a warm sweater eating cheese and drinking wine. But that none of them should be trading with each other the things that they uniquely, you know, if all three of these countries are also making, say, you know, cotton shirts, then that's not something they should be trading with each other, because at that point, then the country that has the advantage with regard to labor is going to start wearing down the others. That's really what David Ricardo brought to the equation, you know, 50 years later, 40 years later, in 1814, with his iron rule of wages and his idea of competitive advantage.
Well, I think the scenario I just described also would be called isolationism, you know, and maybe that needs to be readdressed. I mean, it should be a clue that the demonization of that word that has occurred in the last, you know, let's go back and take a look at that, you know.
Well, that's the point. I mean, you know, Cato comes on and they say, hey, you're an isolationist or you're a nationalist for that matter. And I'll say yes.
That should be a red flag right now. Good talk.
Thanks a lot. Hey, Larry, before you go, did Adam Smith actually use the membrane metaphor?
My paraphrase.
Okay, good one. Thanks a lot. I actually got that. I'll just give credit where credit's due. I borrowed that from Rob Call, who was on our program last Friday. Rob's an old friend and a brilliant guy, and he came up with that idea, wrote an op-ed piece about it a while ago. And in fact, I had breakfast with him Sunday morning. I said, do you mind if I borrow that? And he was like, no, go for it. So anyhow, credit where credit's due. Tom in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind?
Hey, you know, Harry Truman said you learn economics, so you won't be fooled by economists. This Cato guy, there's a couple of things that really bothered me. Number one, the suggestion that tariffs are being eliminated or lowered for humanitarian reasons, I find incredibly insulting, number one, because that's obviously not why they're doing it. And the way he cavalierly dismissed the plight of low-wage workers, talking about increases in GDP or unemployment, as if you're underemployed working at Walmart, that any of those things are going to mean anything to you. And I think Harry Truman might have been the last president who spoke a language of economics that Americans could appreciate, being that he addressed wages going up.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Well, you know, oddly enough, Dwight Eisenhower talked about that, too. He wasn't anywhere near as outspoken as Truman, nor as progressive as Truman, but he acknowledged labor unions. He did not work to destroy them, even though he was a Republican, and helped build this country.
I think economic success in this nation needs to be redefined to include wages. I mean, wages have been flat basically since about 1970.
Well, actually, 73 is the year that they peaked.
73, the benchmark. Well, I mean, yeah. I look.
But 80 is the year they started the precipitous decline.
Yeah, well, and middle class incomes have only gone up about 22% over that time period. But the reason they've gone up is because culturally we've got dual income earners in families now, not because we're getting paid anymore. And
right.
Meanwhile, productivity of the American worker has more than tripled over that same time period. And then,
as have the profits of the corporations.
Yeah. And the thing to remember, I think, is that American workers do not they're not afraid of competition as long as they're competing with countries of comparable living standards. Yeah. And the idea that we can compete with somebody who's going to be making a dollar an hour, I'm sorry.
It just doesn't work.
Of course not.
Tom, I'm right there with you, and I'm going to give the last word here to Mary in Green Bank, Washington. Hey, Mary, we just have 30 seconds or so left. You had a comment you wanted to share with us.
Yeah, I just wanted a quick point to make about the illegal immigrant. And one thing our government has never used in this situation is some common sense. Everyone knows that big business and any business is their bottom line is profits. Now, no one has thought to give a tax incentive to these businesses for signing up the immigrants.
My take on it is they already have so many tax incentives as it is. Corporations are paying about 12% of the total load to keep this country going right now. And during Eisenhower's time, they were paying almost 50%.
Yeah, well, that's great, but I know running a business myself and farming that the bottom line is tax incentives to keep your business afloat.
So if you had an incentive to hire, interesting. Mary, thank you very much for sharing
that.
You're
welcome. Thank you, Tom. Bye-bye.
Good to hear from you. It's interesting thoughts. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, conservative David Thebold is concerned about what he calls do as I say, not do as I do conversation that illegal immigrants, he says, are having with their children in public school. I'll be saying, what? Why are we no longer teaching civics in school? David Bacon from Pacific News Service will be here, too. That and more. And remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.